The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
This is a budget that doesn't duck our nation's problems. It confronts them head on. It's a budget for an aspiration nation.
Aspiration or exasperation? As Britain attempts to shake off a financial crisis rooted in a credit-fueled property boom, George Osborne presents his grand plan for a bigger and better credit-fueled property boom. Meanwhile, he's forced to admit that attempts to cut the deficit have ground to a halt and living standards are accelerating into reverse. It's back, and it's madder than ever. The euro crisis returns, this time in Cyprus, where the banks have put the shutters down and the shops are refusing to accept credit cards. Mediterranean island has been given till Monday to find 6 billion euros or face oblivion. And despite months of deliberation and a multi-million pound Leveson inquiry, new rules regarding press regulation are cooked up in a midnight meeting in Whitehall. What does it all mean for newspapers? And did they really forget about the internet? Joining me for all of this, we have The Observer's political columnist, Andrew Rawnsley, The Guardian's political columnist, Michael White, and The Guardian's economics correspondent, Philip Inman. A warm welcome to you all. Now, as a schoolboy, so his biographers tell us, George Osborne would dream fondly of delivering tough-talking Thatcherite budgets. Last year, he proved that, unlike the lady, he was very much for turning. This year, he offered up his tribute version of that popular 1980s number, Right to Buy.
Today, I can announce Help to Buy. The deposits demanded for a mortgage these days have put home ownership beyond the great majority who can't turn to their parents for a contribution. And that's not just a blow to the most human of aspirations. It's a setback to social mobility, and it's been hard on the construction industry too. This budget proposes to put that right, and put it right in a dramatic way.
So, Andrew, I'm sure Phil will have something to say about the economics in a minute, but politically, he really is back in Iron Lady territory there, isn't he?
To an extent, yes. I mean, in the jargon, he was operating in a very tight fiscal envelope, which in plain English means he had absolutely no money to spend. I was surprised, and I think some others were, that nevertheless he managed to come up with the odd flourish, some of those flourishes pleasing to the Conservative MPs behind him. But as is always, or very often the case with budget flourishes, they then begin to unravel afterwards. And in the 48 hours since he announced the Help to Buy scheme, we just heard the clip, we've had all these questions still not really resolved, whether this will end up actually helping some people, the rich, to buy second or third homes. And then there is, of course, the big question, which you raised yourself, Tom, whether government should be in the business of subsidising people's mortgages and possibly laying the seeds of another of the sort of crazy property booms, which were part of the reason we're in the mess we're in now.
And Phil, on that point, you know, the economics of this, is it sound like to you like it could work, and who's going to gain from it?
Well, I think one of the problems he's got is this issue of downgrading. So he's the downgraded chancellor, as Mr. Bowles characterises him. And if he's been playing, as he has for 3 years, to protect this AAA credit rating, you know, what was that all about? We've lost one, possibly going to lose another credit rating, we'll lose the AAA status. You know, why not go for bust? You know, he seems to be just clinging on to this, as you characterise it, the envelope of spending that he's given himself. Why not break out? You know, he's still got 2 years before an election. It's obvious this policy is not working. You know, expansionary austerity, as we've come to characterise it, simply is not true. It just contracts the economy further and further. Why not have a go for broke? But he obviously is hemmed in by ideology, by his own, you know, last 3 years of telling the nation this is all that he can do.
Mike, you're going to challenge this grumpy Guardian Towers consensus that we've got?
Well, everybody's entitled to be grumpy. It's a miserable situation. It's an awful situation. And when we mock the Cypriots for taking Russian hot money, some of us think, well, and they're not the only ones sitting on a lot of Russian hot money. It's awful. Everybody else is in an awful pickle. Does that make us feel better? No, not particularly, because we can't sell goods to our European neighbours. One of the more interesting facts in Osborne's budget really surprised me, that we no longer sell more than half our exports to the EU. I haven't heard that for a very long time. What's more, that exports to Russia are up 100%. 20%, China up 120%, or the other way around, even more for Brazil and India. Wow, that's interesting. Is it a good thing? I expect Bill Cash and the Eurosceptics will say it is, but that's where the growth is, and we're surrounded by countries in big trouble, and it's awful. Has George Osborne made much of a difference? Frankly, no. Phil Ilman said he's boxed in by ideology and his own record, and, you know, making so much of the AAA rating from those idiot rating agencies. But he's also boxed in by the markets. People have begun to notice if you can't grow your way out of all these problems we've got, out of the deficit and the debt and unemployment. The unemployment is still a good spot in all this. We should be grateful for that. It's nowhere near as high as people thought. If we can't grow our way out, how are we going to do it? By more cutting? That's no good. We've established that. But is the Labour Party in a very credible position in 2015 or sooner to do anything about it, to lead us out of this deadlock? On the evidence of Ed Balls' speech yesterday, which I listened to, no.
Andrew.
Yeah, well, I agree with Mike. Labour cannot afford to be complacent or crowing. Now, naturally, they're certainly tempted to be crowing at times like this. As Phil says, George Osborne has failed his own test, the almost test he fetishised, keeping this AAA rating. As Mike says, the economic situation for a lot of people remains miserable and has been for a long time. But Labour should worry that when you look at that crucial question to voters, which of the rival teams do you judge to be more economically competent, or do you trust more on the economy? Pollsters vary the question between themselves, but we know what the question is. Then suddenly, Labour's headline lead in the national polls disappears. Most of the time, it bumps around a bit. Most of the time, though, the Conservatives lead Labour on that crucial polling question, which I often think is a better indicator of true feelings of the public than the headline poll leads, and that should worry Labour a lot.
Let's just explain, why do you think that is? Is it just that it was present on their watch, or is it that, you know, we've heard Phil say you can't have expansionary austerity, you can't get the debt down by cutting spending, but doesn't it sound even less plausible to the public to say you can get borrowing down by increasing borrowing?
I think you touch on lots of important things there. One, yes, the car was crashed when Labour was in office. Now, you can blame Labour entirely for that, as the Conservatives do. You can say that's a bit unfair.
More than a bit unfair.
But we know it's a fact, and we also know the Conservatives are going to the next election saying, would you give the keys back to the guys who crashed the car? Second thing, Labour still has a lot of work to do on its fiscal credibility. And the third thing, the Tory slogan, how do you solve a borrowing crisis by borrowing more? Now, that's terribly simplistic economics, but as a slogan, I have to say it's quite effective. It's short and snappy. And the reply from Ed Balls, the Keynesian reply, that growth will eventually bring down the deficit quicker than the George Osborne policy, takes a lot longer to explain.
And is it definitely right anyway, Phil? I mean, if we cut VAT this year, as Ed Balls said, wouldn't we end up with a slightly bigger hole in the public finances? Or do you think it really would pay for itself?
We have a bigger hole in the government finances. That is the problem. We're going to be borrowing about $250 billion more than we thought we would when we started this in 2010, when we get to 2018. That's the problem for George Osborne, is that his policy has created a bigger debt mountain. So yes, you can say it's a gamble to go to borrow more to grow, but it was a gamble to cut in order to grow, and that's failed. So I think the argument is one. The problem is, and I pick up on what Andrew's saying, and it's across Europe, is that no one believes governments can help. Governments presided over a crash. Whoever was in power, Sarkozy, far, you know, right winger in France, you know, it doesn't matter. They all crashed the car, and no one is prepared to give the keys.
Hang on. They didn't crash the car, Phil. The banks crashed the car. And the blame of the government, all of them, left or right, in the United States as well as the ones you listed, is that they certified the car fit to drive with its MOT.
And didn't breathalyze the bankers and didn't send
this speed limit. That's right. Let's kill this metaphor. But the credit rating agencies were just as bad, the ones which are persecuting us now. They were definitely asleep during the MOT. But governments have taken the blame. And governments are therefore, bankers have taken the blame too, but governments have taken more of their share, and it suits the Tories to blame Labour. The trouble is, I sat through Ed Balls' hammering of Vince Cable, the great Keynesian yesterday in the budget debate. And when he'd finished beating up on Osborne and Cable, who took a lot of this nonsense from Balls when he was a Treasury Minister under Gordon Brown, said, well, it was me who warned you against the credit bubble, and Vince is right. He was just about the only one, wasn't he, Andrew?
Yeah, he was.
So
yeah.
Vince is in a strong position. And when Balls said, you told us you were going to cut borrowing, and now you're increasing borrowing, old Vince says very mildly, well, I'd have thought you ought to welcome that. The Chancellor has shown that in adverse European circumstances, he's flexible enough to do a little extra counter-cyclical borrowing. Don't forget, he's a real economist. Counter-cyclical borrowing.
And also stabilises.
Yeah, that's right. And it takes the sails out of Ed Balls. But it's much deeper than the fact that Ed's fingerprints are all over the failure to control the famous no more boom and bust, Gordon Brown. That Labour's really got to, if it's going to spend more or borrow more, it's really got to rethink the purposes of the welfare state. It's got to say, do we spend all this money on X, Y, and Z? In fairness, they weren't for ring-fencing the NHS in 2010. They always said that. I think they're right. They're going to have to do something about pensions, better-off pensioners. I'm afraid that includes me and the little bus pass I feel in my pocket as I talk. They tackled university funding, very unpopular, but at least they did that. We're going to have to cut back on all sorts of things while spending and borrowing in things which allow us to invest, allow the economy to grow. We've almost got to go back to being a sort of developing, in our case, redeveloping economy where you prioritize the things which will generate jobs and prosperity and growth in the future. It's going to be awful. And Labour's in opposition. They should be doing the deep thinking.
Already this week, I've seen some columnists, Andrew, starting to say 2015, good election to lose, which seems a bit early in the game for
yes,
that.
Yes, but this is predicated on the idea which the Institute of Fiscal Studies has been particularly promoting, that whoever wins the next election will then have another very grueling time and taxes will have to go up. Do you know, I very rarely meet politicians who say an election is a good one to lose. Very occasionally you get them to admit later, they say maybe it would have been better if we lost that one. They're normally in it to win.
Yeah,
and just
right.
Remember that things look pretty bleak at the moment. At some point, economic growth will resume. We're not quite sure how healthy it will be. There's arguments about whether long-term trend growth has been damaged, and so we can't expect it to be as healthy in the future, but it will resume. And at some point, a government will be presiding over resumption of growth and hope to get some credit for it.
What do you think, Phil? People talk about Japan now, don't they? Like, stuck in the doldrums for years and years on end.
Yeah, I don't think we're Japan. We don't have the same kind of society that is in kind of denial about its problems. Remember, they've kept their banks going for 20 years now that have been bust, in effect. And they've just only started to think maybe after 20 years we need to start to change this. And they've devalued their currency by about 25% in the last few months, but just by talking down their economy, which they, of course, hate to do. That's part of their pride, is talking it up. So they're about to embark on a journey, which we've always been on. You know, we'll happily, you know, ditch our pride quite often if it makes a buck, you know. But I think that Andrew's right, we will get some growth. I'm sure whoever's around at the time that it happens will take the credit for it. Exactly when it's going to happen, you know, the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility, Osborne's watchdog, has been predicting it. This year was supposedly the year of takeoff, you know, the point at which we escape velocity, as I think they've one person called it, would take hold. But you know, will it be 2 years' time? I'm not sure. Yes, there will be a bounce.
And Mike, can I just ask you very quickly, because although the public will be left baffled about the technicalities and will be feeling very clearly that there's not much of the progress Phil's talking about for the future just yet, the government has been making some pretty big political choices. So the IFS were talking yesterday about, you know, if they hadn't, for example, done the stuff they've done on income tax, personal allowance, and what they've done on petrol duties and one or two other pet projects, then all those huge cuts in welfare could have been avoided. Correspondingly, they could have chosen not to put up VAT. It's almost impossible to separate from the failure, if you like, on the big picture. But How well or badly do you think George Osborne's doing, just in terms of not the growing, but the giving and the taking?
Well, he got some relatively positive headlines yesterday in the corniest way that I can remember all my life. A penny off beer, boring. As Ball said, one of his better jokes, buy 321 pints, get one free. And then he added, even William Hague couldn't drink that much. That's all a bit pathetic in a sense, although it's pandering politics. The housing stuff, as I think somebody said a minute ago, is quite dangerous. Fact is, British house prices overall have fallen only by, I think it's 15 or 16% since the peak. Of course, in some parts of Britain, they've fallen far worse than that. In many parts of London and the southeast, because all that hot Russian money isn't all going to Cyprus, come in and kept the prices artificially high, price young people out of the market. So the idea of trying to boost property prices with subsidies at the moment strikes many people as disastrous, although we do want to get the construction industry back in business. We do want it building
that,
affordable
it,
houses and infrastructure, maybe even the wretched HS2, a train to Birmingham, things which will help grow the economy. I'm back to that point. And I don't think Osborne, although he's done a few things, the budget was what they call fiscally neutral. In other words, in theory, it didn't take any more than it gave away, and it did give to low earners, except, of course, it takes away from them in other ways. That's the trouble. Most of them are objectively worse off despite the cut in their tax bill.
Let's leave this rather downbeat discussion here. There's more on the budget for anyone who's not sick of it yet at guardian.co.uk. But if you think the finances are bad in Britain, remember there could also be an awful lot worse. For 5 years, the Western world has been devising shields to conceal the reality that when a bank goes bust, taxpayers end up paying. Well, this week in Cyprus, they've been trying something new, removing that shield altogether. Finance ministers suggested that since a conventional loan was never going to get repaid, Cyprus should simply take the required money out of its citizens' bank accounts. And the banks have been closed all week as politicians weigh up their choices between financial and political annihilation. The EU has issued a final take-it-or-leave-it deadline of Monday. Philip, who do you think is going to blink first now?
Who can tell? I mean, I can't see Cyprus leaving the euro myself.
Would it start that great contagion that we've been talking about a year ago, if you know, with Greece and then Italy and all the dominoes falling, do you think?
No, I don't think so, but the fear is there that it could. So just the fact that it could, you know, the Italians are closer, I think, than people think to saying this, stuff it, you know, we don't need this.
Sorry to interrupt, but if you wanted to have a laboratory experiment on what would happen if somebody left the euro, because, of course, it was designed that nobody should ever be able or would want to leave the euro, I suppose the best place to try it would be Cyprus, because it's so small, and your chances of putting up a firewall to prevent contagion into Greece and Italy and Spain will be that much better. If you wanted to design a Petri dish experiment, what actually happens when a country leaves the euro? Because we wouldn't. I mean,
we do kind of know. I mean, and that's why it won't happen, is because if you've got any money, okay, you're crying now about paying 7% surcharge on your bank deposits if it's under 100,000. I mean, personally, I've lost an awful lot more than that in the currency depreciation of the pound and my pension being halved over the last 5 years. So, you know, really, Mr. Cyprus, you know, you've got to get real here. But anyway, if you've got any savings, they're in euros. Now, if you leave the euro, you then have your own currency. You don't lose 7% of your money. You lose 90% of your money. So anyone who's got any money, and remember, the poorest, who we all bleat on about quite rightly, won't have any money, most likely, then in savings. So you've got to put that. So they're all going to be, anyone who's in the professional classes, the middle classes, they're all going to be telling their politicians, yeah, we want a deal and we don't want to leave the euro because we don't want to lose our money.
Phil's taken this rather tough line, Mike, that, you know, not the worst thing on the world.
I think I basically agree with Philip. Andrew's Petri disc is all very well, but if anybody leaves the eurozone, then the prospect of contagion in the southern flank of Europe is considerable. It destroys the credibility of now and for always of the currency. May well happen, but after the German elections, that's a very important political detail. If Merkel gets re-elected, and she will, she's the best show in town. It's not a great show, but she's the best part of it. Then they may move towards, a German politician on the radio this morning saying, you know, you can't have national budgets if you have international underpinning of those budgets. In other words, if you mutualize the debts all these people have recklessly racked up, who are we to talk? If you mutualize them, then you've got to mutualize the budget process. In other words, Berlin having an overview. And that's pretty scary, but it's worse than that, because if you go back to 2004, what happened? Poland and the Visegrad 10, whatever they were called, the big countries of Eastern Europe were coming in. The Greeks threatened to veto the whole thing unless we let Cyprus in. And everybody, including Tony Blair, said, oh, very well, all right, even though they didn't want to. And now it's all come back to bite them. And it's terrifying. And what's more, the Russians, in a geopolitical sense, not only looking after their money, I suspect they're after Cypriot gas, Cypriot bases, and all sorts of things.
War,
interesting, isn't it?
Oh, dear, oh dear.
But the Greek link is closer than that, because part of the reason the Cypriot banks are in trouble is because they were forced to take a big hit on the Greek debt write-down, which the Germans forced through.
So, and on ordinary punters, too, that's the point. But if you rescue ordinary punters, as the Greek Parliament wants us to do, people with less than 100,000 euros, what's that, £80,000?
The only way long-term you make this work, and certainly satisfy German public opinion, is to have a degree of pan-European oversight over individual countries' budgets. But is that really going to be sustainable long-term? You're telling me when the Spanish finance minister announces a budget, or the French finance minister, or the Italian finance minister, what, the Germans or Brussels are going to come along and say, despite the fact you're the elected government, we're vetoing your budget. Mm. I don't think that's long-term sustainable, and that's why we've got to think very hard. And a lot of the hard thinking isn't going on, because there's elections, as Michael says, there's German, very important German election. I agree with him. I think Angela Merkel will win it coming up. But also, we lurch from crisis to crisis.
So, Phil, it sounds like, I mean, consensus, you've got to rethink the basic architecture. But surely also, we're talking about 6 billion euros. That's a fraction of a percent of Eurozone GDP, isn't it? A tiny amount compared to some of the other bailouts we've been talking about.
Yeah, which is
so
why the why
this
the,
isn't going to bust it, surely.
No, it's not. And why the markets don't really care, because they can see that it's a tiny amount of money. And also, compared to the previous crises we've had, the European Union has put in place a big bailout fund which can absorb this without any problem, should they want to. The fact is they don't want to, because they want to take a kinder view of Greece, because they think Greece is a real problem, so they're being hard on the Cypriots. Now, that's really backfiring.
They don't like Cypriot banking practices either. All that.
No, they don't. And they, but the fact is that they should take the hit, because they've allowed all this to happen. Like the fudge you described, Michael, 6 years ago, they should look back and think, yeah, we screwed up. We should now just pay up and get and move on. And whether that's a banking union or whatever, but they have to forgive some of these debts and take it on the chin that it was their fault for allowing it. Now, that's obviously a hard thing for politicians.
But aren't we being a bit like, you know, you get these very hardline economists who'll say, oh, don't worry about cutting wages if that's what's needed. You know, cut wages only the same as them being eaten up a bit by inflation, except that it isn't. And that's what we've got with this bank account thing, isn't it? It sort of feels much more sort of impersonal, and it's not quite clear who's taking money from you and when if the currency devalues, as in the same way as it is if they're just saying, right, we'll have this.
Although I don't think, I mean, we've talked about the blame that belongs to the bankers, quite rightly, and to governments, quite rightly. But we also, and different European countries have responded to this differently, we also have to say the public, to an extent, are to blame too. I mean, there were Greeks who...
Where are you going with this, Andrew? Where are you going with this?
There were Greeks everywhere across Europe. There were Greeks who were not paying their taxes. There were Greeks who were buying things they really couldn't afford. Some countries, and Greece, which I adore Greece... some countries have been rather in denial and have displaced all their anger about the mistakes of their own politicians and themselves as voters onto the Germans. I think in other countries, the Republic of Ireland is an interesting example. There's quite consensus in the Irish public. Go to Dublin, people say that they all knew the boom had got reckless. There's a much more collective national consciousness that things got out of hand And most of us share some responsibility for this party in which we all participated. So, yes, let's blame the government, let's blame the bankers, but voters do have some responsibility of the state we're in as well.
Well, more doom and gloom if you want it at guardian.co.uk/business. But now back to Britain. We had the Leveson inquiry and its shelf-bending report of recommendations, and now, 6 months later at least, Parliament has acted. But does it amount to state legislation of the press? And will any of the newspapers at the heart of the original wrongdoing sign up to the recommendations anyway? One man who isn't is the editor of The Economist, John Micklethwaite, who spoke to us earlier.
I think in the end, the difficulty from a journalist's point of view is that we all have to be very honest about this, and you come down to a choice. And there is a choice between looking after one fundamental right, which is the right of people to some degree of privacy, and the other is the freedom of the press. And if you favour a system of journalists policing journalists, I think you have to be honest and admit that that is going to probably end up with more abuse, more abusive behaviour by journalists. If, on the other hand, you decide that the freedom of the press in the end is the most important thing, then you have to accept that that comes with that. And I think in the end, confronted by that, I would still say that the freedom of the press is the bigger liberal issue. And I'm aware of the conflict of interest we have in putting that across, but I think it comes straight from the core of what a liberal society is. The idea that this thing was carved together at 2 o'clock in the morning over pizza and with representatives and hacked off strikes me as mad. If ever there was a really difficult subject which required time and systematic consideration, then I think it's this. And that is where my worries come from.
Mike, we saw a lot of it put quite bluntly there, because up until now there's been a lot of discussion in terms of things like independent self-regulation, which, when you think about it, are slightly slippery terms, aren't they?
Well, Micklethwaite, the Economist man there, does indeed highlight a dilemma. And some columnists this week, interestingly enough, have said, well, the answer is simply to enforce the law, the existing law. We all knew that on phone hacking, bribing coppers and all the other things the rascals at the lively end of the trade get up to, you know, they were breaking the law, and the police, and in some cases the politicians and other groups, were turning a blind eye to it. A bit like whiplash injuries in the insurance business. It's not just the press who are hard to manage here. But we also know of a long history of drinking in Last Chance Saloon, and we've all been there completely legless in Last Chance Saloon for years, that you know, it hasn't worked very well, and I see no evidence that it will. The paper said they'd go with Leveson, and within weeks they were running away from Leveson. I agree that things cooked up in the middle of the night aren't satisfactory. Exemplary damages is very worrying. The exclusion of the internet is very worrying. But these things can be fixed. The real question is, does a royal charter meet the situation? I'm happy to take Oliver Letwin's clever man that he is word for it that it does. A couple of paragraphs of statutory underpinning. This can be made to work with goodwill. I don't think we're going to get goodwill from the bulk of the newspapers if they think they can get away with it. And they're the ones who've behaved very badly. They continue to behave very badly. They sacked Andrew Mitchell, the chief whip, the other month. They do dreadful things all the time. They still do, even though they protest about Lord Leveson's chill effect on their journalism. And most of what they do isn't in the public interest. It's just a laugh. Sorry, I come down against Micklethwaite. I do so reluctantly, but I've been in this business for 45 years and I know what goes on.
Andrew, I mean, do you understand this detail? It's all been changing so late at night, and God knows, you know, yeah. Royal Charter, all that stuff. In the end, is it up to these journalists like Micklethwaite to just say, I want nothing to do with it, and they can all do that and pretend the whole thing goes away?
Well, the threat to them if they don't play ball and then they lose court cases is they get punished with what's called exemplary damages. And that was a sort of key Leveson proposal to give you an incentive, or as some would say it in the press, a coercive effect to make you join the system. Because if you didn't join and then you behave badly, you'd really get hit by very big fines in the court. Now, this is very, very contentious, but it was an attempt at least to create a mechanism, because our industry's got to face it. I mean, our last attempt at self-regulation was pathetic. It was completely useless. And you can see why both the politicians and the public don't trust us to have another go. And when we're saying, well, we really, really will get it right this time, right to the last, some elements of the press were saying we should have the right to veto any appointment to the regulator. Well, there's a clear problem with that, because that could potentially give the press the power to mark its own homework every time, just to stack the regulator up with people who are going to always lean to the press. We would not tolerate that with any other profession, and I don't see why the press should expect to give a special pass on that sort of element of regulation, for instance.
Finally, Phil, this is an industry, obviously, that is in a certain element of decline, and I just wonder, do you think, like, the kind of imposition potentially of exemplary damages for people who don't play ball, or new regulation for people who do, could it speed up the death spiral?
It's definitely not an industry in decline. I have new readers all the time, all over the world. No, they don't pay for it, but they are everywhere and growing. So
he's been programmed, as I haven't, hasn't he?
But I think my problem with this is and this has been something that the Guardian and other parts of the paper has documented quite well, is the Defamation Bill basically dying because this whole Leveson thing has taken over, which is a real problem, because we have these hugely outdated libel laws and they desperately needed updating, and it looks like that might get shoved out because of all the wrangling.
Okay, well, let's leave that there. There's plenty more on Leveson and its aftermath on our sister podcast, Guardian Media Talk, which is up today and on guardian.co.uk. My thanks to Michael White, to Andrew Rawnsley and to Philip Inman. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.